Good morning, everybody. There's a couple of more sheets here. You have one? Very good. It's nice to be back. Thank you very much. I appreciate your welcome. It's been a snowy and cold 2 weeks in America, so driving round to find students. I calculated that over the course of the 10 days that I was there, I drove 1,800 miles around and about to try and find people, which hopefully some of that was worthwhile. I apologize this morning. I seem to have woken up with a bit of a frog in my throat, but no French people, no French jokes, I'm afraid. But we'll see how it goes. The plan, Be'ezrat Hashem, for the next few weeks up until Pesach is to talk about issues to do with minhag. Minhag is a very critical part of our halachic system, and I'd like to talk today a little bit about what minhag is, and maybe what minhag isn't. And then over the next few weeks, we can look at a few specific, interesting, modern-day minhagim, things that we do today that we didn't used to do, or things that we used to do that we no longer do, and how that works. And we'll put that together. And then after Pesach, as I said, I'd like to turn to a different topic. Please God, I'd like to look a little bit more at embryology and the unborn child and halachic issues to do with that. And then we're into the summer, and that's a different conversation. So let's start with minhag. The one place in the Tanakh that the word minhag is used is in the following. In source number one, at the beginning of Malachim Bet, the issue is Yehu. Yehu is a man who has been anointed the king of the northern kingdom, and he's been told that he will take over from the existing kings. And Yoram HaMelech, who is the current king, has been told, you know, that's it, he's got to fight for his kingship. And Yehu comes in and makes war against Yoram. And there is a parley, there is a peace, if you like, conversation, where Yoram sends out messengers to Yehu, and Yehu's driving around down in the field, and there's a watchman looking down, seeing what's going on. So look at number one, it says, Vayaged HaTzofeh, and the watchman, the guard who's looking down to tell Yoram what's going on, and what's happening with their parley, Lemor, this said the following, Ba'ad Aleihem, the guy came to Yehu's crowd, Velosha, but he never came back, which is a bit suspicious. And how do we know it's Yehu? The haminhag kaminhag Yehu, and the driving is like the driving of Yehu ben Nimshi, ki b'shigayon ninhag, because he drives like a madman. The first Israeli driving experience in Tanakh. Yehu drove like a meshugana, and therefore he says to God, I know for sure it's Yehu, because I can tell immediately by the crazy way that he drives. And I think there's something going on. And in fact, what happened after this is they went to war against Yehu unsuccessfully. And therefore, the word minhag is used here in the context to mean driving, as in nihag. Of course, people on the bus shouting nihag all the time. Some of my seminary students think nihag just means back door when they shout nihag, nihag, to open the door. But of course, you and I know that's not what it means. It means driver. So minhag is literally driving. That's the way the word is used. And therefore, you end up with this beautiful the idea of the Derech Hashem, the route that we go in life, which is called in the Chumash the Derech Hashem. Yisro calls it the Derech Hashem. There is a halakha, there's a way that you go down that road, and that's what we call the halakha, which is the way that you go. That's a set path. However, the way that you go down that road, the method of your personal driving, your style, your own personality, that's called a minhag. Minhag, therefore, brings to the halachic system a certain personality, individuality, community by community, or family by family, or even by individuals, which allows us to be halachic in a way which is not, that we're not each clones of the other, but we have our own personal way of doing things. And we're going to see today that there are a number of different kinds of minhag. There is a minhag which is imposed from above, and there is minhag which comes from below. And therefore I'd like to look together with you at the different kinds of minhag that I think there are, break them down into different categories, and see how they work. First of all, Just looking at the categories in an overview, there are basically three or four types of minhag. There's a minhag which is created by Chazal or by the Nevi'im, where that's just another form of rabbinic legislation, but it just has a form, a rubric of minhag. We'll see what the difference is between a minhag, in that sense, and a takana, or a gezerah, but it comes effectively from Chazal in the way that other rabbinic legislation does. Two, it's just called minhag. Then there are other minhagim that came after the Gemara, which in that sense are not binding on all of Klal Yisrael, because nothing after the Gemara is binding on all of the Jewish people, because not all of the Jewish people have accepted. Only the Gemara is the last thing that all the Jewish people accepted. So after the Gemara, there can be no binding acceptance on everybody, but individual people, communities accepted, minhagim made by local rabbis, local communities, we'll talk about those. And then there are very specific local minhagim made by people, by families, by individuals, by communities, and we'll see how binding are they. Are now binding on the descendants, binding on the communities, and we'll see many examples of these over the next few weeks. Some examples, for example, of the last categories where there are minhagim which are imposed from below, I brought down five different ways this can sometimes work. For example, communities may take upon themselves an extra stricture, something that is not halakhically required, but they say, we don't want to do this, there's some kind of offense around that. But that's not a rabbinic fence, that's a locally adopted fence. For example, kidniyot, everybody's favorite minhag, right? Kidniyot on Pesach. I'd like to talk specifically about kidniyot closer to Pesach, when everyone gets excited about kidniyot. But that clearly seems to be something that communities accepted. Nowhere in the Gemara is there any hint that there is a problem of kidniyot. On the contrary, it says explicitly that Chazal ate rice at their Seder night, and therefore we'll have to see where that comes from. But that seems to be some kind of astringency communities have adopted on not eating milk and fish together, for example. We'll see where that comes from. Sometimes there is a local minhag to follow a particular opinion in halacha, where there's a machloket, and they say this community's minhag is to go like this and not like that. So there's a minhag, if you like, which feeds into the halachic system. Sometimes their minhagim are in monetary matters, local customs which are binding, even though the halacha says nothing about them. For example, the halacha specifies a number of different ways of making a kinyan. You can lift something up. A kinyan is a halachic form of ownership. You can lift something up, you can pull something, you can hand something over, but the idea of a handshake, or in an auction, the fall of the gavel, to indicate that that's, you know, sold to the lady in the back, except wearing the grey coat, that's not you, it's alright, it's fine, you didn't buy anything. That is a local minhag and can be binding in halacha. Then there are rituals and customs that we know in our tefillah, in our nusach, in our life cycle events. We'll look a little bit about these as well. And finally, there are areas like Dat Yehudit. Dat Yehudit is based in minhag. Dat Yehudit is what we call tzniut today. The rules are not rules, maybe they're not rules, maybe they're customs as to how this works, and are they binding, in which way are they binding, on what people wear, how they wear it, how people act, whether women do this, whether men do that. And of course, it's not just about women, it's about men as well, in different areas. A few months ago, there was a hullabaloo in London about the bells, the community where the women don't drive. And there was a lot of there were a lot of things said, which some of them were less intelligent than they should have been, about that community. Is this a legitimate minhag? Is this something that has a basis in any way? And is it binding? And on who is it binding or not? And that's the kind of issue with Dat Yehudit. Maybe we'll talk about Dat Yehudit as well. That's a very important form of minhag that people often misunderstand, but I think we should talk about in this forum. So let's talk about, first of all, the minhagim that come from above. Minhag from the Nevi'im or Chazal. Have a look in the Rambam, in source number 2. The Rambam, when he's talking about the halachic system and rabbinic law, he says the following: Beit Din, Shigazru Gezerah, if the Beit Din, he's talking about the Sanhedrin, when we had a Sanhedrin, who made a Gezerah, or Tiknu Takana, or they made a Takana, Vehinhig, Vehinhigu Minhag, or they created a Minhag, they made the people take on a certain Minhag, Upashat Adava Bachol Yisrael, and the Jewish people as a whole accepted this, Va'amad Achrein Beit Din Acher, and later on a subsequent Sanhedrin comes along, Ubikesh Levatel Devarim Arishonim, and they want to try and cancel out the earlier Beit Din's Gezerah, or Minhag, or Takana. They're not able to, says the Rambam, actually, a Godlamin, or a Shonim B'chochm or Minyan. Now, I'm not getting into all of this now. We talked a bit in the past about this. When could a Sanhedrin overrule another Sanhedrin? And not for now. But it's interesting, the Rambam here gives three different kinds of rabbinic law. The Takana, where the Beit Din, where the Sanhedrin, created some new positive institution. Let's say, davening Shmona Esrei. There was a takana. They said everyone has to daven shacharis. Now, when they daven shacharis, they have to say these 18 brachas became 19 brachas. That's a takana. Or a gezerah, where Chazal, if you like, make a fence around a Torah law, and they say something like, for example, you can't eat chicken and milk, because we're worried that you might come to eat beef and milk. And next week, by the way, I'd like to talk a little bit more about specifically the minhagim of milk and meat, and waiting between milk and meat, and everyone seems to do something different, and into this hour, into the fifth hour, into the sixth hour. You know, I've never yet met anyone who waits into the first hour, but we'll see that's not so ridiculous a suggestion. That may have been what the original minhag was, but we'll talk about that. But what is a minhag? How does minhag work? So the Rambam understands that minhag is part of the mitzvah of Lo Tasu. There is a pasuk in the Torah, there's a verse in the Torah that instructs the Jewish people, one of the 613, actually two of the 613, Lo Tasu min adav asher yaruch, yamin usmal. We are not allowed to deviate from whatever Chazal told us to do, as a takana, as a minhag, as a gezerah, to the right or to the left, and we've talked about that a little bit in the past, more in the future. And the Rambam says minhag is part of this as well, and we'll give some examples in a minute. Key number three. Anyone who doesn't keep the ruling of the Sanhedrin, is breaking a negative mitzvah. I don't care, says the Rambam, whether it's something they received from Sinai as a tradition. That's what we call the oral law. Or something that Chazal and the Sanhedrin developed. They interpreted the verses in a certain way. And they created, if you like, this new interpretation of the Pesukim. That's also included in Lo Tasur. Or things that they created as a boundary fence. These are gezerot, takanot, v'hamin ha'got. Interestingly, he calls them minhagot, not minhagim. Minhagim may be a slightly different thing, we'll see from the bottom up. But there are such a thing as minhagot, and they're all included in Lo Tasu. Meaning, sometimes Chazal created a rabbinic law, and they gave it the rubric of minhag. And that makes it different from other things. And now I'm going to give you some examples, and we'll see how that works. See number four, for example. There is a custom that we have on Hoshana Rabbah of Arava. Of a rover. We take the arova and we smash it on the floor. This itself is a zecher to what they used to do in the Beit HaMikdash, where they used to take the arova and they used to have these massive willow branches, and they used to walk around the Mizbeach every day of Sukkot, and on Hoshana Rabbah, on the great Hoshana, they used to walk around seven times with these big willow branches. Where does that come from? There is no mention of that anywhere in the Chumash. The Chumash says you have to take Arba Minim, Lula, Esrog, Shkoyach. It says that. Where did Arava come from? So look at number four. Rabbi Yochanan ben Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Chad amar Arava Yesod Nevi'im. One says that Arava is Yesod Nevi'im, a foundation of the Nevi'im. Chad amar Arava Minhag Nevi'im. And one said it's the Minhag of the Nevi'im. Who cares? What's the difference between a Yesod Nevi'im, Minhag Nevi'im? So look at Rashi number five. Yesod Nevi'im who? Takanat Nevi'im. He says, this is a takana. In other words, on the one understanding, it's a takana. Nevi'im achronim, Chagai Zachari Malachi. Shehayu mamti, memetakne takamas Yisrael. Because they created new takanot for the Jewish people. At the beginning of the Second Temple period, many of the rabbinic takanot were made by Ezra, here by the later Nevi'im. Anshei Knesset Gedola, as part of the Anshei Knesset Gedola, this is where our tefillahs come from. This is where Kiddush and Havdalah, in terms of the Nusach, and the wording of Tfilah, etc., all comes from there. So according to the first opinion, Rabbi Yochanan, it's a takana. However, the second opinion is, it's a minhag. So look at Rashi. Hinhigu et ha'am. It's not that they made a takana. It's that they told the people, this is what you should do. This is more of a minhag. V'lo tiknu alem. They didn't tell them from, if you like, a takana perspective. What's the difference, says Rashi? Nafkamina, the difference to us is, the loy boy bracha. Because usually things which are a minhag don't require a bracha. The lekelamema vitzivanu, because you can't turn around and say vitzivanu. God commanded us to do this. Dafidu bichlal lo tasu leisa, and he actually disagrees with the Rambam as to whether it is or isn't in lo tasu. But the word vitzivanu means God commanded us to do this. Now, in what sense did God command us to do a rabbinic takana? So God commanded us to listen to the rabbis. But says Rashi, a minhag may be a little bit different. If something is a minhag from Chazal, it may have a different rubric, and it may not have the same issue in terms of Hilchos Bracha. In fact, we find that on the Arava that we take on Sukkot, we don't make a bracha on the Arava. We only make a bracha on the Lulav and Esrog. It's interesting, Lulav is only a mitzvah min HaTorah on the first day of Sukkot. Every day of Sukkot after that, it's a takana. It's a rabbinic takana. Zeicha l'migdash. We take a Lulav on the last 6 days of Sukkot to remember that in the Migdash they used to take a Lulav all 7 days. Do we make a bracha on Lulav and Esrog for the rest of Sukkot? Absolutely. Because you make a bracha on a takana. Whereas Arava, says Rashi, could be a minhag, in which case a minhag we don't make a bracha on. They're both binding, they're both a halachic, if you like, obligation, but there is a different format of the halacha. This has a very big implication, for example, in second day Yom Tov. Second day Yom Tov is also expressed in Chazal as a minhag, even though this is a halachic requirement. I don't mean minhag in the sense here that some people use the word minhag in a very loose sense. I don't know, my minhag on Sunday mornings is to have scrambled eggs on toast. You know, that's not my minhag, by the way. I'm too busy on Sunday morning to do anything because I live in Israel. You know what it's like. There is no Sunday morning. But, you know, that I don't mean minhag in that sense. Minhag in the sense of second day Yom Tov is not like, if you like, if you don't like. It's binding. The question is, in what way is it binding? Look at number six. Says the Gemara in Beta. Hashtu yadin under bekfiyat siyacha. The Gemara asks the $64,000 question when it comes to second day Yom Tov. Now that we have a fixed calendar, my time avim, why bother with the second day of Yom Tov? We talked about this in this forum. Why bother with the second day Yom Tov? We know which day is the real day. So the Gemara mishum de shalchu mitam, because they sent out a message from Babylon and they said the following: Hisharu b'minhag avoseichem b'yadeichem. Keep your ancestors' minhag. Why? Zimim de gazru shmada. If God forbid, they would be a shma, they would be persecution in future years, and people will mess up the calendar, and people won't know which is the right day. So keep second day Yom Tov, because it's minhag avoseichem biyadeichem. Okay, very nice. So do I have to keep second day Yom Tov in Brooklyn? For sure. Now, do I have to keep second day Yom Tov in Jerusalem? Okay, so that may depend to some degree. Is it a minhag, or is it not a minhag? Everyone agrees that it's something which is binding. Rambam says, number 7, Aval Hayom, these days, says the Rambam, Shebnei Eretz Yisrael somchim al ha-cheshbon, everybody today relies on a fixed calendar, u'makashin alav, and everyone, the Kiddush HaChodesh is not by witnesses, it's by fixed calendar. Ein Yom Tov Sheini lehistalek min ha-sofek. The second day Yom Tov is no longer because of a doubt. There's no doubt anymore, we have a fixed calendar. Ela minhag bilvat. It's only a minhag. Interesting. Now, that doesn't mean it's optional. The Rambam has it absolutely binding. But if it's a minhag, maybe it takes on the halachas of minhag as opposed to the halachas of anything else. Now, how does it work with a minhag? If you have a minhag, in Brooklyn you keep second day Yom Tov. And if you go to a place where they don't have that minhag, do you still have to keep your minhag or do you not have to keep your minhag? Depends who you are. So the Gemara says, if you go to a place where they don't have your minhag, and you go there permanently to stay, so then that's it. You lose your old minhagim, and you take on your new minhagim. So clearly, if second day Yom Tov is minhag, and you live in Brooklyn, and then you come and live in Yerushalayim permanently, everyone will agree. You certainly don't have to keep 2 days Yom Tov because, well, actually not everyone will agree. It does depend who you are. There are other opinions, but almost everyone will agree. Because your minhagim have changed. You're now a Yerushalmi, and you used to be a Brooklynite. However, if you are only coming to Israel for a few days and you're going back to America or back to London, so there is, if the halacha of second day Yom Tov is minhag, then there's a different situation. Because when it comes to minhag, if you go to visit a place, says the Gemara in Pesachim, nothing to do with second day Yom Tov there, talking about something else, if you go to visit a place with intention to return, what's called das or lachzor, your intention is to come back, you do not take on the minhagim of the new place. You keep the minhagim of your old place. You just have to adjust them so as not to upset anybody in the new place that doesn't understand your minhag, but you keep your old minhag. So if second day Yom Tov is really based in minhag, then for sure someone from Brooklyn who comes to visit Yerushalayim will definitely have to keep 2 days Yom Tov, because their minhag hasn't changed. There's still someone who lives in America, and their minhagim do not change in that way. That's if second day Yom Tov is a minhag. However, what if not? Have a look at number 8. Says the Rambam elsewhere, Bizman azeh she'ein sham Sanhedrin, based in Shal Eretz Yisrael, kovim ala cheshbon zeh. Here in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, the Rambam says, these days when we no longer have Edim and a Sanhedrin, Hayamin Adin Sheyu B'chol Makom Asos in Yom Tov Echad. Really, in theory, everywhere has to keep one day of Yom Tov Bilvad, because everyone knows the right date. V'afila Makom Asos Rechoy Kishe B'chol Zlaret. Even in theory, places in London and in America really should keep one day Yom Tov Kibbeno B'nei Eretz Yisrael, just like the people in Israel. Because everybody relies on one fixed calendar. So why do we not keep one day Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz? Why do we keep two, says the Rambam? Here he doesn't just say the word minhag. Aval takanat chachamim hi. It's a takana. Sheyizharu b'minhag avoseinu v'avodeichem. Whoa! I thought you said it was a minhag. Now you tell me it's a takana? Maybe that's different. Why is that different? Because if it's a takana, and it's not really based in minhag, so maybe it's straightforward. In Israel, the takana is one day of Yom Tov. And in Chutz La'aretz, the takana is 2 days of Yom Tov. So if you come to Israel to visit for 3 or 4 days, just for a week for chag, maybe the answer is, no, now you're in Israel, that's the takana in Israel. It's nothing to do with minhag. In Israel, you keep 1 day. In Chutz La'aretz, you keep 2 days. So one of the underlying issues as to whether you keep 1 day or 2 days in Israel may be to some degree based on, is it a minhag, quote unquote, from Chazal, that we keep 2 days of Yom Tov, in which case it follows your minhag wherever you are, or is it takana, which is here yes, there no. So there are implications as to whether a minhag from Chazal is a takana, or whether a ruling from Chazal is a takana or a minhag. Even though they're both binding, they may be binding in different ways. So that's one kind of minhag. But there are other kinds of minhag. What about after Chazal? And this is more what we today think of as minhag. After Chazal, no one can make a new ruling that binds all of Klal Yisrael. They have to use some other formula. That's why, by the way, when Rabbeinu Gershom in France, in Germany, in the 9th, 10th century, decided it was a bad idea for people to marry more than one wife, which was generally speaking accepted in the Ashkenazi world, although not necessarily in the Sephardi world. In the Sephardi world, if you look at a Sephardic Subba, very often it says in the Sephardic Subba, the husband makes a promise to his wife that he won't marry more than one wife. Okay? She needs to check that wording is there, otherwise she may get a surprise one day. In Ashkenaz, I never promised that to my wife in the Subba because I'm Ashkenazi, and therefore I can't have a second wife. Anyway, I don't particularly want one, certainly not another mother-in-law, that's for sure. I love one mother-in-law, it's just perfect for me. In case she's listening to the shir. If you're Yemenite, by the way, you don't necessarily put that in the Ksuba either. And therefore, there are Teimanim with more than one wife. The question is, why? Why am I not allowed to take more than one wife? What right does Rabbeinu Gershom have to bind me in any sense? And the answer is, he didn't make a takana. He made a cherem. It's a cherem. It's called the cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. The cherem being that it's binding on me, and if I don't follow that, I'll get thrown out of the community. Okay? And therefore, you see that after Chazal, people have to find other mechanisms to create new, if you like, halachic practice. And one of those is cheirem, as we saw. One of those is minhag. So if you look here in the Rif, look at number 9. The Rif, who's living already after Chazal in the 11th century in North Africa, he says the following. He says, what is minhag? Ikar ha-minhag, the essence of minhag, he says, that we have today, is she'ayis in al-piv, and we follow minhag, for who she'rayiv ha-kahal. If most of the people in a community, yitya'atsu im ziknei hakahal, take advice from, they consult the leaders of the community, v'itasu takana, and then those leaders of the community make a ruling based on what? Based on the people. The people say, we'd like to do this. Is this okay? And the leaders say yes or no. Kamashi taksu v'ikanu ota, okay. Zehu minak. This is minak. Where the people want to do something, and they check with the leaders and say, can we do this? Is this a nice new thing? They say yes, so then it becomes a minhag. V'afilu la'ach ha'shnaim, or ha'shanim, sorry, even after many years, im lo yadu hach ha'ikro, we don't exactly know where the minhag came from anymore sometimes, ela she'hayu machzik b'kach, but we know that people are absolutely firm with it, and they don't do anything else. V'hayu amet b'chezkato. That minhag remains, even though no one can really remember exactly what the minhag was or how it started. But nevertheless, this is the minhag of the community. You can't always ask on a minhag. In fact, very often you can't ask on a minhag. Why? Because it comes from the people. Says the Rif, it comes from the people with the consultation and approval of the elders of the community, but it doesn't come from the top down, it comes from the bottom up. And therefore he says this has a binding nature. We'll have to see why it's binding, in what way is it binding. Similarly, the Rosh writes a similar thing in number 10, the makom she'halacha rofefet biyadecha. When it's not entirely clear according to the halacha what you should do and what you shouldn't do, sometimes the halacha is a little grey. Halachacha minag. Follow the minag. Minag can be a machria, it can decide the halachic practice. Peirush, what does that mean? Im yesh rifayon bahalacha. If there is a weakness or a doubt in the halachic ruling, she'ein barur lecha, it's not entirely clear, k'min nifsika halacha, do we follow this one? Do we follow that one? V'ra'it she'nogim, and you see the people do a certain thing, halachacha minag, follow the minag. Ah, what if the minag doesn't always necessarily make sense? D'yesh litlot she'nireh legedolim, like the Rif said before, you can assume if the Jewish people, and we'll see which Jewish people are we talking about, but if the Jewish people follow a certain practice, that they checked it with the leaders of the community, and those people either explicitly or implicitly allowed that minag to continue, we can assume that minag is valid, because the Jewish people, we'll see, have a kind of collective nevuah. And therefore trust, says the Rosh, trust the Jewish people. And this is a very important point in minag. The Jewish people have a certain, as I said, nevuah ruach hakodesh, and therefore their practice can actually create a binding practice, even though it might not seem to make a whole lot of sense. You see this in many, many areas. In Hilchos Brachos, for example, what is the bracha on chocolate? Which is strange, because you would have thought the bracha on chocolate should be bravery high, because that is the only way that we really eat the fruits of the cacao tree. That is, there is no other way that we really eat that fruit, and therefore the normal way that you eat the fruit of a certain tree should be a bravery height. The minig is not to make bravery height, the minig is to make shahakol and chocolate.
Because you don't eat the fruit, it's like coffee beans.
Good.
And you grind it.
It grows on a tree.
Good.
Yeah, people don't eat them as raw beans. People don't eat them as cooked beans. People grind them up and turn them into chocolate. The only way that people eat that fruit in normal society, because break for eight, is the bracha you make on the normal way that you eat the fruit of that tree. Not necessarily. That is there's another alternative. For example, orange juice. What is the bracha on orange juice? Everybody makes charcoal on orange juice. Why? Maybe orange juice should also be brave for eight in terms of, in theory, halachically. Why? Because the normal way that you eat the fruit of the orange tree today, in 2017, is not as oranges, but is as orange juice. The vast majority of oranges grown in the world are grown in order to turn them into juice. Therefore, the normal way that you eat oranges in this world today is orange juice. So maybe orange juice should be borei peri ha'et. That is the way that we eat the fruit of that tree, as opposed to as an orange. Maybe eating an orange is an unusual thing. We do, but if you ask most farmers, what are you growing your oranges for? What is the ultimate produce of this crop? The answer will be orange juice. Yes, orange juice. Orange juice is a worldwide massive, massive, massive market. And a lot more.
It's a massive market, but it's not, what's the word? It's not exclusive?
No, of course it's not exclusive. But we often eat different fruits of the trees in different ways. Correct, the cocoa bean is exclusive. So you think it's a better question on the cocoa bean. So now you like my question on the cocoa bean.
No, the cocoa bean is definitely shekel.
Yeah.
We don't eat it
as a bean. And that's exactly the point. We only eat it as chocolate.
The same. Coffee bean?
Good. So coffee already is mixed with water. So a good shadow. What bracha would you make on a coffee bean? Meaning, there's a lot of interesting halakhic issues that come up in these questions. But at the end of the day, there's a certain minhag. There's a certain minhag. People have a minhag, and that's what they do, which is very interesting.
Yes, but the cocoa bean is everything.
Okay, fine. I'm not going to eat the whole hilchos brachos shit. I'm just telling you that it's not as obvious as you think. It's not as obvious as you think that we make the bracha that we make.
All the liquid.
That's not entirely true either. There are, if you were to drink olive oil, for example, if you were to drink olive oil. One second. The Gemara discusses, what if someone were to drink olive oil? And not as a medicinal, for the medicinal purpose, but they mix it with some kind of something sweet to make it nice, and you drink the olive oil, Let's say, what bracha do you make on drinking olive oil? Not as a medicine. The answer is berefri ha'ez. Because that is the normal way that you eat the olive tree. Now, we don't do that anymore. Again, that for sure is true. Because olives are definitely grown for olive oil as opposed to for olives. People also eat olives. But people eat all sorts of things in all sorts of different ways. I'm just saying that even though a fruit you may be so used to a certain halacha, the Gemara says, for example, we should have had a special bracha on olive oil, which is borei peri hazayit. It should have been borei peri hazayit parallel with borei peri hagafe. Okay, borei peri hagafe. But he said we can't make borei peri hazayit because zayit means both the tree and the fruit. Whereas Goffin only means the vine. And therefore it's downgraded not to Breperi Zayid, but to Breperi Ha'et. But it's not Shehakol. And therefore, Hilchos Brachos is often more complicated than people think, and the Minhag may often be Machriya. Yes?
I thought that the Bracha and Shehakol is origin, what it comes from, but what form, what's the
last... Not always. Okay, that's because the normal way that people eat potatoes is as potatoes. If you mash the potato to such a degree that you can't even recognize it's a potato anymore, so fine. That's a different thing. I can see we need to have some shirim on Hilchos Brachos, which is not what I propose to do right now. Okay, I'm not going to say any more about Hilchos Brachos. It was just an example. The only point I wanted to make is that Hilchos Brachos, in theory, is often quite different from what people do, and what people do defines the halacha. And of course, you're absolutely right. You do make shehakol on chocolate, and you do make but that sometimes to do with minhag. The Mishnah Brura asked a question: if someone brings you a lachaim in the middle of a suda, you have whiskey in the middle of a meal, do you make a bracha on that shehakol in the middle of a bread meal?
No.
Three no's. You're quite right. You don't make a bracha on that. Why not? Good. If someone brings you a glass of wine in the middle of a suda and you never made kiddush, do you make a bracha? No. On a weekday, someone brings you a glass of wine in the middle, do you make a bracha? Why isn't part of the suda? Much more important?
No, because you did make a guffin and hamotzi.
Good. The reason is because the guffin has nothing to do with the suda. The guffin is something else, something different from the suda. It's a separate thing. Wine has its own chashivas. And therefore, if you bring wine as part of the suda, it doesn't come machmak of suda. It's not part of the motzimech and lechem in aret. Therefore, it needs its own bracha. Says the Mishnah Brura, the truth is, if someone brings you a nice 18-year-old Scotch whiskey in the middle of a meal, what's that got to do with the lechem either? Really, it should have its own shahakol. Why not? Why is it not chosh? The answer is, the minute is not to make shahakol, we don't make shahakol.
By the way, even if you do say kiddush, you have to bring on another...
Hakov ha-native... Okay, so we can get into our discussion. Hatov HaMeitiv, lots of things need to go into making Hatov HaMeitiv. You have to know the wine is better. You have to not be there before. I'm not getting into that now. Anyway, Minhagim often define the way we do things. You asked a question about compote. Fine. Why? Why is Minhag binding if it's not coming from Chazal as a Takana or as a Minhag as a Gezerah? So there are a number of possibilities. Look at number 11. There is a mitzvah in the Torah of Hasagat Gvul. What is Hasagat Gvul? Not moving a boundary fence. Number 11. Lo taseh gvul re'echa asheh gavlu rishonim. Do not move the boundary of your friend, of your neighbor, which the earlier one set b'nachalatcha in your inheritance, asheh tincha ba'aretz, asheh Hashem lokecha no tincha l'rishta. The question is, why does it include in that mitzvah asheh gavlu rishonim? It didn't need to say those words. It could have just said, don't move a boundary fence. This is a straightforward halacha. Don't get up in the middle of the night. Move your fence a foot into your neighbor's property to get a foot more land. That's called stealing. It's stealing land. That's called a sagas kvul. So if you look here, the Rishonim in number 12, it's brought by the Torah Tumim, Ashe Gavli Rishonim, Mikan, from here, says Rav Shri Rigoyen, the Minhaga Milta. Minhaga Milta. Minhag is a thing. Minhag is real. Minhag is not just whatever you want it to be. It's based on Hasagas Gvul. Similarly, the Torah brings down a Shulchan Aruch, number 13. Chayav kol adam lebil tishanus minhagam. People are not allowed to change the minhag of their own minhag. Damrinan, as we say, minan ala minhagam milsehi. Where do we know the minhag is a binding thing? Shneemar al tasik vorecha ashe gavlu rishonim. So in that sense, there may be there's a smach, maybe even a derivation from a Torah mitzvah. I also brought you quite unusually Philo. Who was Philo? Philo was a first century philosopher in Egypt, a Hellenized Jewish philosopher, very much not part of the classical halachic Masorah. Although it's interesting, those who are interested in YU history, Dr. Belkin, who was of course the dean of YU for many years, Rabbi Dr. Belkin, did his PhD thesis on Philo and the Torah Shebaal Peh. So if you wanted to read something interesting on Philo, no doubt you could call up his PhD thesis and see what he had to say. So Philo says the following in the book 40. Isu ze gam l'shmirat minhagim. There is also a prohibition that requires us to keep minhag, ha'atikim, which is ancient. Ki ha'minhagim hein, because look at how he defines minhag, very interesting. Chokim shelo nichtavu. They are laws which were never written down. Laws which were never, we'll see when it comes to tzniut and our definition of minhagim and dat yehudit, that's exactly how Rashi says it as well. Takanot anashim, they are takanot, but from the people, miyamei kedem, from ancient days. Yiladim minadin hushin chal me'evoteh. Children inherit from their parents, says Philo. Milvat nichzehem, not only their property, but minhagi avot shebehem gadlu, but the minhag, they inherit the customs of their parents, which they grew up with. V'chayu me'arisat yaldutam, from the earliest time, from the cradle. V'lo yavuzu lehem, a person should never disparage the minhagim of his family. It's part of his inheritance. Mishum she'nimsaru v'loy te'uda shebichtav. Just because they're not written down doesn't mean that you should look at them any less seriously. And that's a very important point. We often make this mistake. The Rambam, in his letter to the Jews of Marseille about astrology, makes the point in the other direction. He says, why do you trust something more just because it is written down? The Rambam says, people often say to me, oh, well, you know, I've seen it in writing. Ashkayach. People sometimes say to me, you know, you said this, where's that in writing? Okay, give me a pen. Here we are. It's in writing. You trust it now? The other says, no, because nothing in writing is trustworthy just because it's in writing. There's a famous story, who was it? Rav Avadia was asked by somebody that she bought something with a hesher. It didn't say Mahadrin, men of Mahadrin. And he said to her, he said, fine, it doesn't matter. And she said, yeah, but it doesn't say it in writing. So he said to her, fine, get out a pen, write on the hesher Mahadrin, men of Mahadrin. And now you'll be happy now. Okay? So in other words, on that particular issue, I'm not saying that Rabbi said that generally about Mahadrin Hashem, but this particular issue, the writing didn't change anything. So Philo here says, equivalently, just because something's not in writing, it doesn't mean it's any less valuable. So too, you see here in Mishlei, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, Al tasik vul olam asher asu avotecha. Do not move a boundary which your parents set. And Chazal themselves say, number 16, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, im ra'ita minach she'asu avoteinu. If you see a minhag that our fathers kept, al tashan al tov, do not change a minhag. You should not be quick to change a minhag. Kagoim, and he brings an interesting example. Abraham tiken at tefilat shacharit, Yitzchak tefilat mincha, Yaakov tefilat arvit. Interesting. The roots of shacharit, mincha, and maariv are in the minhag of the avos. Shalot oma af ani osif acharet. Don't say, oh, I'm going to make my own thing and add on to a minhag. Talmud Laman, it says, Asher Asu Avotecha, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Loi Asa, Ela Lekol Hadorot. They didn't just make it to themselves, they made it for all future generations. So this idea of Hasagat Gvul, whether from the Pasuk or whether from Mishlei, is a basis for the binding nature of Minhag. Yes?
Women often take on Minhagim of their husbands. What's the basis for that?
So we'll talk about that. That's the kind of issue of a community and family. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. When is family Minhag binding and what is your family? And how do you define what your family is? Now we'll see that there is such a thing as a minag, which is a minag shtus. There is a minag shtus. A minag shtus is that some people can have a minag which actually goes against the halakha. That doesn't have a binding nature. We'll talk about when is a minag not a minag. Not today, but we'll talk about that. When I grew up in shul, when I was a boy, it was absolutely standard during duchening, during Birkat Kohanim, that everybody turned around and faced away from the Kohanim. Turned their backs to the Kohanim. Not a single person in the shul faced the Kohanim. And it was based on superstition and this and that, misunderstanding. You know, they said, you know, if you look at the Kohanim, you go blind. And if you look again after you've gone blind, then you'll die. How do you look again after you've gone blind? Okay, don't ask Kashas. You know. So the people all turned away. This is completely against halacha. When someone gives you a bracha, you have to be facing them when they give you the bracha. There's a minig shtus. The Aruch HaShulchan is very upset about the minig in Chutz La'aretz, and this, by the way, is maintained the minig by many people, that in Chutz La'aretz, in some places, when Yom Tov falls on Shabbos, they don't duchen. When Yom Tov falls on Shabbos, so they don't do Birkat Kohanim. They don't duchen when Yom Tov falls on Shabbos. And in some places, they do duchen when Yom Tov falls on Shabbos. So, you know, where does that come from? The Aruch HaShulchan is very unhappy. It's nonsense, wipe it out, get rid of it. Other people say no. Yeah. Well, not in Israel where we duchen every day, but in Chutz La'aretz, in America, when Yom Tov, they only duchen on Yom Tov. When Yom Tov falls on Shabbos, do they duchen or don't they duchen?
They don't, because Shabbos
takes precedence. Well, what's the problem? So Shabbos is no problem here, duchening. So exactly, you have to work out, where does the minhag come from? Is it based on something real? Is it based on something which is a mistake? How does it work? So there is a concept of a minhag shtus. We'll have to deal with that and see how we define it, but not now. Another issue is Torah Simecha. There are different kinds of Torah coming from different places. Famous pasuk Shema b'nimos Rabicha, Ati Torah Simecha. Look what Rashi says on the word Torah Imecha, number 18. Ati Torah Simecha, Minhag Mekomcha. Interesting. Rashi says Torah Imecha is Minhag Hamakom, meaning it's not coming as a musar, as a masora, straight from the halachic system. It's coming more in a mimetic way. Mimetic means that people do it because other people do it. People pick it up because other people do that. A lot of the stuff that we learn when we grow up in life is learnt as Torah Imecha. It's not, strictly speaking, you know, been read in a book. In fact, many things that we do, we never read in a book. We just do them because we do them, because we always did them that way. And this is actually ruled in Halacha, number 19. The Erev Pesach Kodem Chatzos Tolu B'Minhag. Do you do Malacha on Erev Pesach in the morning?
Yes.
So the answer is yes, in most places, but it depends on Minhag. Markum Shenagul Atois Oisin Kol Malachas Afilu Shalot Etzarech HaMoed. In a place where they do proper malacha, you can go to work on Erev Pesach in the morning, so people go to work. Ubamakim shenagu shaloi la'asayis, in a place where people have a minhag, but they don't do work on Erev Pesach in the morning, ain't so you shouldn't.
So why shouldn't the Kohanim
sing also? Why should this not apply to you? Good. Nara pashta, we'll see that maybe you can do this and you can do that, unless you feel that it goes against the halacha. Meaning, if there's a halacha that you should duchen, and somebody came up with a reason, don't duchen because it's Shabbos, and there's no good reason for that, then you're not duchening, which is a problem. Whereas if you don't want to do malacha on Erev Pesach in the morning, shashkayach, you don't want to do malacha on March the 27th, no, whatever you like, you know, you don't have to do malacha. You're not breaking anything. So here he says you can do whatever you like in your community. It's whatever your community does. V'af b'nei machreim atzoyf kaladoyres hadarim be'ir hazot. And anyone who lives in that town for all time has to follow that minhag. Ein rishayim l'shanot min minhag avasayim. They are not allowed to depart from their ancestral minhag. Why? L'shum shenema, because it says, al titosh torat imecha. This is a halachic concept of torat imecha. It's minhag. It comes down to us from this more mimetic, general background tradition. So that's another kind of minhag. Mimetic means something you learn, like the word mime. There's something you learn from imitation from other people rather than from reading it in a sense. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who in YU, who wrote a very famous article about 20 years ago called Rupture and Reconstruction. Okay, which, by the way, I've just been told he is rewriting and updating for the 20 something years since he wrote it, which will be very interesting. See, that article was a seminal article about how when he was a boy in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, a lot of Judaism was mimetic. People did things because they saw that's how they were done. They didn't have necessarily, they couldn't quote a verse, or they couldn't quote the halacha. They didn't have little, plastic measuring sheets at the Seder table to measure this much matzah and this much maror and this much this and this much that. They just did it because that's what the Zaydi did, and the Zaydi did it because that's what his Zaydi did, etc., etc. Says Rav Chaim, Judaism changed significantly after the Second World War for all sorts of reasons which he gives. And it became much less of a mimetic and much more of a textual religion. The people do things not because that's their tradition or minhag, but because that's what they read in the book. And, you know, what? And the whole question that he's asking in that article is, why is the Judaism of our great-grandparents not good enough for anyone anymore?
Not that it's not good enough. A lot of the elders from the Holocaust were lost. They perished.
Right? So read the article, see what you think. You don't have to agree with him, and see what you think. Let's have a look at minhagim from communities. Okay? Where they didn't perish, it's still not good enough. That's the problem. The minhagim created by communities are slightly different. And here we have to look at the concepts of neda. Look at number 20. Vayidabi Moshe el Roshei HaMatot, Bidnei Yisrael Emor, Zeh HaDavar Asher Tziva Hashem. Right at the end of Bamidbar. Now remember, Bamidbar is basically the end of the Torah. Devarim, Mishnah Torah, is Moshe's last speech, where he goes over the Torah, adds a few issues in. But really, Bamidbar is like the closing lines of the original Torah, if you like, before Moshe Rabbeinu gives his final speech. And he says, Ish ki yidor neder. If a person wants to make a neder l'Hashem, or he shava shavua le'isur isa anasho. If he wants to make a prohibition on himself, lo yachel devaro. Lo yachel devaro. His words or her words cannot be chol. What does the Torah mean by chol here?
Secular,
profane. You cannot take this less seriously just because you said it. Kachol ayotem ipir, yatzeh. Whatever you said you were going to do, this is what you have to do. Meaning, when God tells us to eat something or not eat something, okay, that comes from my Kodesh Baruch Hu, I'll do that. But if I made something up and I said, you know something, I'm not going to eat chocolate for the rest of 2017, so I might turn around and say in a month or two when I regret having, it wouldn't take me a month or two to regret that statement. But if I regret that statement later on, I can't turn around and say, no, you know something, this isn't in the Torah, I made this up anyway, I'll just eat the chocolate. No, lo yachel devaro. If you said it, you made it into a reality. You can create new halakhic reality. And therefore, Rav Hirsch says in number 21, it starts the sphere of what we have called free-willed legislation. Meaning, after HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given all the specific binding legislation, he then says to the Jewish people, if you want to make new mitzvahs, you can. You can make new things for yourself. It opens the possibility for individuals as well as communities and the nation as a whole to establish permanent rules for ensuring the faithful keeping of the dictates of the Torah. And this is what we call Nedarim. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, when he talks about Minhag, says Minhag is part of Nedarim. Look in number 22. Dvarim ha-mutarim v'hayoydim bahem shehem mutarim. Something which is mutar, something which is allowed. Give my example of chocolate. And you know that it's allowed. This chocolate is kosher. There is no halakhic problem with eating this chocolate at all. Nagu bahem isa, but you take on a minhag. So my minhag is, even though this is really allowed, we don't do this. Havi ke'ilu kiblu aleihem v'neder v'asur l'hafiram lahem. If you take on a minhag, that is as if you had made a neder, says the Shulchan Aruch, and then you're not allowed to break that, and you may not even be allowed to do hataras nedarim. A minhag takes effect as a neder. Tilkach, therefore, mishu ragel hitanot haniot shelifnei Rosh Hashanah. If somebody has a minhag that they fast certain days before Rosh Hashanah, v'shavim Rosh Hashanah, v'yom kippurim, shibein Rosh Hashanah v'yom kippurim, sorry, and between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, many people have different minhagim. They fast between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Someone who says, I'm not going to eat meat during that period, Shalol Ishtad Yain, Rosh Chodesh Av, or from Rosh Chodesh Av, Ad Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, or Om Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, meaning there are periods of the year where people have a certain minhagim that they do eat, they don't eat, they fast, they don't fast, etc. Urote Lach Zorbo, and now they want to break that. They've decided they don't want to do that anymore. Machma She'enu Bori, because they're not healthy. And they regret now that they took on this minhag to fast, or to not eat meat, or to not drink wine during Tisha B'Av, etc., the week before Tisha B'Av. Sorry, you can't just break that. That is binding. You now need a beis din of three men to release that neder. The im b'shar shehitchel in hog, hayadasa min hog kein olam. If your intention when you took on that minhag was to do that permanently, the nahag kein afilu pa'amachat, and you even did it once, you suddenly decide to yourself, I'm going to read Tehillim, I'm going to finish Tehillim every single day of the year. I'm going to read 150 Prakim of Tehillim. And the first day you took it on, you read 150 Prakim of Tehillim. I was on the plane back from America, there was a guy sitting across from me. He picked up Tehillim at the beginning of the flight in Newark, and he basically just read Tehillim the entire time from the beginning to the end. He probably finished like Tehillim on the 10-hour flight. If you say you turn around and said, I want to do that every day, and you do it the first day, that's it, it's binding. On day two, you're in trouble. You need Hataras Nadarim, because that's your minute. Tarech Hataram, Vipatach Bacharoth, and you have to explain now, you regret it, etc.
V'fikach, therefore, harotzel linhag b'ksad dvarim hamutar. If you want to take on minhagim, he says, yomer v'tchila hin hanagata, you say before you take on the minhag, she'einu mekabel alav b'neda. You say bli neda. Now, I know that everyone says bli neda all the time for everything these days. Everything's bli, this bli neda, that's bli neda. Okay. There is a real reality in halacha to the concept of bli neda. That if you're about to do something which could be a binding minhag, even if you do it only once, and by the way, if you didn't have anything in mind, but you did it three times, as we know, that also becomes a binding neda, we don't mess around with nedarim. And therefore, minhagim, says the Shulchan Aruch here, have a form of neda. An individual minhag is an individual neder, and a communal minhag is a communal neder. And therefore, when the Jewish people as a whole take things on, that has real halakhic significance. And it's actually more of a problem, because I, as an individual, if I say something ridiculous about not eating chocolate, I can always try to do Hataras Padarim. I mean, there's no guarantee that the Beis Din will release it. But as an individual in a community, what can I do? I don't like it, let's say, that I can't eat kidneys on Pesach. And I actually don't like it, because I'm gluten-free and therefore rice is, you know, one of the things that I eat a lot of. But never mind, it's fine, I can manage. Let's say I want to get out of that neder. What can I do? Hataras Nadarim? Hataras Nadarim doesn't work. It's not my neder. How can I take the entire Ashkenazi community since the year 950 to a Beis Din so we can all do Hataras Nadarim together? The only way I can get out of that minhag is by leaving the Ashkenazi community, which is actually very hard. Like a mafia, you know? Once you're in, you're in. If you want to get married, maybe that's a good way to leave the Ashkenazi community. But as a man, first of all, that doesn't help me. I'm already married, and Rabbeinu Gershon already nixed that one. And secondly, even if I'm not married, marrying doesn't take you necessarily out of the community, and the wife might take on your wife might take on your minhag. Maybe back in the day I could go and live in Yemen. And it's not today. But you could go and live in Yemen, and maybe you would say, okay, there's no such thing as an Ashkenazi in Yemen. You know, that's it. You become a Taimani, that's it. Again, Rav Avadia said there's no such thing as an Ashkenazi in Eretz Israel, really, either. Why are you an Ashkenazi in a Sephardi country? He has many statements about this, and this is a whole, okay, fine, that's a much more complicated issue. But you can't just get out of a community in Minhag that way. And we take it very seriously. Look in number 23. This is a famous Gemara in Pesachim, where Hillel is asked a question, the following. Amrulo, they said to Hillel, Rebbe, Shachach v'loi hevi sakin me'erev Shabbos mahu. If Erev Pesach falls on a Shabbos, and everyone has to do the Korban Pesach, and it's Shabbat, are you allowed to do the Korban Pesach on Shabbat? Yes, you are. That's clear. That Hillel taught them. He learned that out from the text of the Chumash. But what if you forgot to bring your knife, and there's no Erev? Are you also allowed to carry the knife on Shabbat? You're allowed to do the Korban, but are you allowed to carry in a preparatory way for the Korban? So he said to them, Amalahim, he said to them, Halacha zo shamati, I did hear that halacha once, v'shacharti, but I've forgotten. Ella, what should we do? Hanach lahem Yisrael, let's leave the Jewish people, im ein neviim heim, b'nei neviim heim. Even if they're not neviim, they are b'nei neviim. B'nei neviim is the expression for someone who went to Navi school, and they're capable of being a Navi, but they just haven't actually been given Nevuah yet, because Hashem has not yet given them the Nevuah. So says Hillel, we don't have Nevi'im today, because we're living in a post-Navi society. We're a non-profit organization now in the Jewish religion. Sorry about that. And and Hillel said, the Jewish people don't have Nevuah, but they're B'nei Nevi'im, they're capable of having Nevuah. Therefore, let's see what they do. Lemachar, the next day, says the Gemara, Misha pischu tler tochvo b'tzmaro. If their Pesach offering was a sheep, the Jewish people, when number 23 in the middle, the Jewish people put the knife in the wool of the sheep. Misha pischu gideon, if it was a little goat, tochvo ben karnav, if they put the knife in the horns of the goat. Ra'am master, Hillel saw what they were doing, v'nizka alacha, and then he remembered alacha, and Amar, and he said to them, oh, that's exactly what I was taught. That's the halacha. You see, I told you, trust the Jewish people, they know what they're doing. And therefore, this idea of Hanach Lehem Yisrael, leave the Jewish people in Ein Nevi'im Heim, B'nei Nevi'im, is very strong and is brought down in the context of Minhag, that the Jewish people have a collective Ruach HaKodesh. This, by the way, was true not only in terms of Minhag, but I brought you, we'll go to page 5 in a second, and just to finish off, but even when it came to the Sanhedrin making halacha,
Back in the day when the Sanhedrin had the authority to create new halakha, the Rambam brings that before they could create any new halakha, they had to first consult with the people. What do the people want? What can the people do? What can the people cope with? And any halacha, says the Rambam, which the Sanhedrin made, which was not capable of, people were not capable of doing, the people didn't want to do, it wasn't binding. Which is interesting, because who's running the show? Are the people, are the leaders telling the people, or are the people telling the leaders? And the answer is, it's a little bit of both. The leaders are obviously leading the people, but they have to do that in close consultation with the understanding and the will of the people. Because the people themselves have this Ruach HaKodesh. Now again, which people? Most Jewish people today drive on Shabbos. That doesn't make it that the Jewish people have a Ruach HaKodesh that now we should drive on Shabbos. It obviously has to be people who are connected to, part of, educated in the halachic system and sensitive to that. But when you're dealing with that community, we do take the people seriously. And that's why there's an expression, Puk Chazima Amadavar. Go and see what the people are doing. Go and see what the minhag of the people is. And that becomes the halacha. That's in source 28, which I'm not getting into now. Rav Haigoan says that one of the greatest proofs for a halacha is Puk Chazi. Go out and see Ma'am Adavar. What are the people doing? And he says, Ze Ha'ika V'Hasmach. That is, in many ways, the authority for halacha is the people's minhag. And therefore, again, we see that the community minhagim are taken very seriously. What about family minhagim? Let's just finish off with this for a few minutes. Are they binding on their family? Because all sorts of people have all sorts of strange minhagim in the family. There are many people who don't eat turkey. I had a close friend at university. He didn't eat turkey. Why? Because way back in hundreds of years ago, one of his family members, a rov in his family, had said, I saw a turkey doing something, which it says in the Gemara, only treif birds do, and therefore I think a turkey should be treif. And therefore we're going to not eat turkey forevermore in our family. Is that binding? So look at the Gemara here in number 29. It's very interesting. B'nei Baishan, no, the loy hava azlin mitzur l'tzaydan b'mali shavsa. This particular family had a minag that they didn't travel from Tzur to Tzaydan on a Friday. When can you travel on a Friday? When can you not travel on a Friday? Should you take a flight from New York to Boston on a Friday morning? Or from London to Manchester? Okay, it's not far, it's only an hour or so, but I don't know, things can go wrong. Traveling on a boat from Tzur to Sidon is the same idea. It's not a major journey, but things can go wrong. So they had a family minhag that they didn't do that. Asu b'naihu, the children later came, kamei de Rabbi Yochanan to Rabbi Yochanan and said, Amram, they said to him, Avosein av Evshalahu, our fathers kept this minhag because they could. But Anu Loi Evshalan, we can't do this anymore. This has become very problematic for us. I don't know, they were a merchant, they were making business deals, and not traveling on a Friday morning was now causing them difficulty. Can we get out of that minhag? Just because our parents did it doesn't mean that we have to do it. So Amalu, he said to them, Kvar kiblu avaseichem aleim. Your parents have already kept you taken on the minhag. Shneimad, it says, Shema bani, Musar avicha, alti tosh torzadecha. The Bavli seems to say, yes, that's it. If your family took on a minhag in a binding way, you are bound by that minhag. The Yerushalmi, when he brings down that story, actually seems to come to the opposite conclusion and says, actually, why? Why should you be bound by your family minhag? Your minhag, you can do hataras nadarim. But your family minhag, how, it's not fair, because you can't do anything about that anymore. You can't take your great-grandparents to a Beis Din to do Hataras Nadarim. Therefore, the implication of the Yerushalmi could be that in many ways, family minhag are not binding. And therefore, we're going to have to look at this in more detail. It's going to very much depend on the case, and maybe even the posek, as to whether the minhag is binding or the minhag isn't binding. Look, for example, at number 32. This is going to be a segue to some degree into next week's shir. Amamar Ukva. Mar Ukva, who was one of the Amoraim, says, Ana laha milta, for this particular issue, chala I am vinegar bar chamra, the son of wine, lagabe ava, compared to my parents. Why? What does he feel that his parents were on a much higher level? They were like fine wine, but he was like vinegar. In what way? Di ilu ava, but because my father, ki hava achel bisra ha'idna, when he would eat meat one day, Lai hava achel gvina, he wouldn't eat cheese, ad lemachar ad hashta. He would wait 24 hours between meat and cheese. So that's what my father did. Ve'ilu ana, but I'm not as frum as that. Bahat sudas aloi, hadaloi achilna, within the same suda, that's when I don't eat it. But the sudas achrisa achilna. But when I get to the next meal, so then I eat it. Meaning my dad used to wait a whole day, 24 hours. I don't do that. I only wait from one meal to the next, which of course we have to define. What does that mean from one meal to the next? But one thing's for sure, he didn't keep the minhag of his parents. Why not? Why don't say that's a family minhag? Our family waits 24 hours. Because he obviously understood, no, that minhag was a personal minhag of my father. It was not binding, it was not meant to be binding. It was his own precious, his own chumrah, if you like. And I'm not bound in the same way just because I happen to be part of that family. That doesn't bind me. So therefore we'll see that it's sometimes things are binding, sometimes things are not binding. And it's an interesting dialectic. We'll just finish with just one idea, which is that, you know, the Rav Chaim Pilagi, in the end, says a very important thing. Just have a look at what he says in 33. We'll finish with this. You're not meant to change any makeup. It's a fixed minute. Okay, this is the Torah of a person, complete Torah. Not to deviate. Because if everyone starts to make things up for themselves, and just do whatever they feel like. And they don't listen to people that came before. Today we'll get rid of this minhag. Tomorrow we'll get rid of the other minhag. You never know where it's going to end. Eventually Judaism is going to look completely different. And everything will go down. And every the Torah will be a new Torah called Dor Vador. So what should we do? So he ends up. We have to follow our own gedolim, and we have to follow the halachic guidance of the people in our own generation. And in this, he's just giving us a little hint of something we'll pick up on in future shira, which is it's a balance. On the one hand, we say chadesh yameinu. We want things to be fresh, to be new. We don't just want to be fettered by what came before us because it came before us. But it's chadesh yameinu kekeder. Now what does that mean, chadesh yameinu kekeder? If it's chadash, it's not kekeder. And if it's kekeder, it's not chadash. Obviously there's a way of doing chadesh yameinu kekeder. We want it to be new and relevant and fresh, but rooted in something authentic and traditional. And we'll have to see how we do that in the different minhagim that we have. But that gives us a little bit of an overview, Be'ezrat Hashem, as to how minhag works. Next week, more on Mar Ukva and his illustrious father who waited 24 hours between meat and milk.